This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On July 25th, 1978, in Manchester, England, Dr. Robert Edwards and his medical team wheeled a 30-year-old pregnant woman into an operating room.
This is Mrs. Leslie Brown, who is now 38 weeks pregnant.
Leslie Brown had been Dr. Edwards' patient for a little over a year.
All our tests have shown that the growth of the baby is satisfactory.
Edwards performed a quick, confident cesarean section on Leslie Brown, and in the grainy video taken in the operating room, you see Dr. Edwards reaching gently into Leslie Brown's womb, as he says,
"This is a girl, as was expected. Baby's in pretty good condition at birth."
In pretty good condition after birth. The cool, calm manner in which Dr. Edwards says those words belies the fact that this baby was making history, for this just wasn't any birth.
You can now hand it to
baby cried at 20 seconds.
That little girl was Louise Brown, the world's first test tube baby.
Want to hold the baby?
3.5 years later, America's first test tube baby was born.
That's a girl.
It's a girl.
Elizabeth Jordan Carr.
And in the generation that's passed, more than 4 million babies worldwide have been born through in vitro fertilization. IVF pioneer Dr. Robert Edwards was awarded the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 2010. At that time, he looked back at the reproductive revolution he'd created.
We knew for the first time that science and medicine had entered human conception decisively, and that from now on we would look at illnesses and diseases and other disorders in embryos as part of medicine.
Robert Edwards died yesterday at his home in Cambridge, England, at the age of 87. Today, Massachusetts remains a leading center for the research, development, and use of IVF.
So we thought we'd take a look back at Edwards' medical breakthrough and how it changed both science and society, plus look forward at what the development of IVF says about how we and society at large may come to accept the next revolution in reproductive medicine. In a moment, we'll hear from one of the leading IVF researchers in Massachusetts, but we're going to begin with Elizabeth Comeau. You heard her name a little earlier as Elizabeth Jordan Carr. On December 28, 1981, she was the first baby born in the United States using in vitro fertilization. She's now a senior health and wellness producer for Boston.com, and she joins us in the studio. Elizabeth Comeau, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good.
Okay, so let's start back with the story of your parents, if we could.
Okay.
And what led them to seeking out or being the first set of parents to have an IVF procedure done in the United States? Tell us about your mother and father.
Sure. So my parents had been married for a while, and you know, my mom was a preschool teacher and just really wanted to have a family, and they had been trying for about 10 years, basically, to have children. And my mother had three ectopic or tubal pregnancies, basically, and wound up with no fallopian tubes left.
And actually, as I read that, I mean, they were quite disastrous.
They were serious.
I mean, she ended up in the hospital and almost died.
Yes. Yeah. The third one, my mother's doctor told my dad that, you know, if he hadn't gotten her here in time, she wouldn't be with us. Mm. So, they were very serious.
Yeah.
And she heard about the procedure. You know, her doctor just gave her this pamphlet and was like, "Oh, I heard this this talk on this thing called IVF, and you know, it hasn't been tried here, but I think a couple down in Virginia is going to try and start a clinic. So maybe you want to investigate this."
Okay, so was this 1979, 1980?
This was probably about 1979, yeah, 79, 80, yeah.
Okay, so what have your parents told you about sort of what IVF meant back then? I mean, did they, when they heard, oh, I've heard, you know, a doctor saying there's this thing called IVF, I mean, were they familiar with the birth of Louise Brown just, you know, a year or two before in 78?
They obviously had watched the news and heard about it, but they had no idea what it actually entailed or what it meant. And you know, my mom always says that it's probably a good thing that she had no real idea. She was kind of blissfully naive about what she was getting into. She didn't quite know.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
So, and what also surprised me in doing the research for our conversation today was at that time, it was illegal in Massachusetts. So
That's
even though they lived here, they couldn't have the procedure done here.
That's right. Yeah. So it was illegal. And actually, doctors Howard and Georgiana Jones, my doctors, had to go through and actually had to have a public hearing in Virginia to get special approval to even open the clinic. And, you know, there were protesters. And so this whole process was very controversial. And, you know, obviously the Vatican still doesn't look upon IVF fondly. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was illegal. And they actually had to go to Virginia to even pursue this option.
Okay. And then so your parents obviously chose to do that.
Mm-hmm.
What was your mother's pregnancy like?
It was, according to my mom, it was very normal. She had no morning sickness. She had, you know, they didn't keep close tabs on her caffeine intake and things like that, you know, back then, because they weren't sure what that all meant. But, you know, fairly relatively easy pregnancy. And I was a small baby, too. And so, you know, I came out at 5 pounds, 12 ounces. So she's not like she was carrying around a 10-pound Whopper, you know?
You know, it's fascinating to me because IVF does feel so commonplace now, mm-hmm. that, and especially in a place like Massachusetts, where there are a number of clinics that people have relatively easy access to. I mean, your parents were living in Massachusetts, but we're having the procedure and care in Virginia. And so, I mean, I read that when, you know, for example, once the embryo that became you was created, it had to be, of course, reimplanted into your mother's womb. But, you know, your parents got a phone call saying, you know, the egg's maturing fast. Get down here to Virginia now.
That's right. That's right. Get on a plane immediately, basically. And luckily, my mother was a school teacher, and so she could kind of, you know, pack up and just get on a plane and head down there. But yeah, I mean, it was pretty much like, this is going to happen now, so let's go.
It's remarkable that they went back and forth as much as they did to make this happen. You know, that brings up another point in terms of how much things have changed between then and now regarding IVF. And it's actually well illustrated in a bit of tape that we have here, again, from Dr. Robert Edwards, who is the man who passed away yesterday, the pioneer in developing in vitro fertilization. And this is a little tape we have from him around 2010 when he won the Nobel Prize for Medicine. And in it, he talks about the lengths that he and his research partner, Dr. Patrick Steptoe, had to go to in order to keep the media away from Leslie Brown, the mother who gave birth to the first in vitro baby in the world in the UK. So here, let's listen to Dr. Robert Edwards.
We've been very worried in the early days that we might lose the baby, well, the fetus, really, because the press were chasing it all over Bristol and England. Secretly, Patrick Steptoe hid the mother in his car and drove around to his mother's house in Lincoln.
So basically, they had to hide her away at Dr. Steptoe's mother's house. I mean, something very similar happened to your parents in the last month before you were born.
That's right. So my mom and dad actually, you know, at that point, she was so pregnant, they wouldn't let her fly anymore, right? So she had to go to Virginia. They ended up renting a condo. And when she was in the hospital, they cordoned off a whole wing of the hospital and put two guards outside of the door. And everybody that was involved in the procedure, I was born 3 days after Christmas, obviously, had to have a special icon on their badge and know the secret code word, which was Operation Santa Claus, just to get into the wing of the hospital. And, you know, we had like, we called it the agent in reverse, basically, at the hospital, who released a false description of my father to the media just so that he could come and go from the hospital. He wasn't like stuck in a room, you know, with my mom the entire time. So, and there's a scene that cracks me up in the Nova documentary of my birth. My dad is actually in a sea of reporters in the middle of all these reporters, and none of them know that he's the dad of the first IVF baby.
I can only imagine how they felt afterwards when they found out that he was standing right next to him. I mean, but did they at what point did they realize that they were on the verge of being the first in the United States?
So my mother, a viable embryo, was implanted back in my mother's womb on her birthday, April 17th, which is coming up. And, you know, when they found out that she actually was pregnant and it was indeed successful, that's when doctors Howard and Georgiana sat down with her and said, you know, you are our first. And my mother and father kind of went, oh, okay. And then they gave them the option to stay private. You know, it could have been an anonymous, you know, anonymous couple from Massachusetts has IVF baby. My parents felt very, very strongly that, you know, if being public would help any other couples learn about this procedure, know that there was a normal, healthy baby out there that they could have, then it was worth the lack of privacy that they would have probably for the rest of their lives.
Hmm. Well, obviously, we've come a long way since then, in the 30 plus years since you were born. I wonder, I mean, you know, given that Dr. Edwards has now passed away, what do you make of how society's attitudes have really transformed since the first days of IVF? Because, I mean, it's almost difficult to remember now that back then there was concerns about Frankenbabies and this being sort of an ungodly act and all the hysteria and extreme global attention around every birth in those early couple of years after Louise Brown was born in 1978.
Right. Well, there's still that. It's just not to the, it's not as amplified, I guess, as it was. And, you know, I, being in my status as the first IVF baby in the U.S., I basically can't run into somebody when I meet somebody and they find out who I am without them saying, oh, my sister, brother, so-and-so, you know, it feels like I'm 6 degrees of IVF. Everybody has somebody in their life that has gone through this. So it's very commonplace. Although there are far more options now than what were available to my parents at the time. So it's a lot more complicated, too.
Oh, interesting. So we'll talk more about that in a moment. Listeners, we're talking about in vitro fertilization, its past, present, and future. Yesterday, Dr. Robert Edwards, the pioneer who invented the technology, passed away in Cambridge, England. And you just heard from Elizabeth Camo. She is a senior health and wellness producer at Boston.com, and she was the first in vitro fertilization baby born in the United States in 1981. So, listeners, has IVF changed your life? What do you make of how reproductive technology as a whole, as Elizabeth said, has changed since 1978? And what does the story of IVF's development from the initial fear over, quote, test tube babies to mainstream acceptance of increasingly sophisticated and complicated reproductive science, what does all that tell you about how society might accept the next major revolution in how we create life? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Elizabeth, if you can stand by for a moment, I want to introduce a couple more guests into the conversation. The first is Robin Marantz-Hennig. She is a science writer and journalist and author of Pandora's Baby, How the First Test Tube Babies Sparked the Reproductive Revolution. Robin Marantz-Hennig, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much.
Also with us is Dr. Selwyn Oskowitz. He's the co-founder of the Boston IVF Clinic. It's the first and largest private IVF clinic in Massachusetts and a clinical professor of reproductive biology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Dr. Oskowitz delivered the first IVF baby in Massachusetts in 1984. Dr. Oskowitz, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
Let me start with you, Doctor. I mean, first of all, tell us about your thoughts regarding the passing of Dr. Robert Edwards and what that means for the science and overall of reproductive technology.
Well, of course, it's very sad, but we are tremendously proud of Dr. Edwards and what he's done, and we were thrilled a couple of years ago when he won the Nobel Prize in recognition for this achievement, which has influenced the lives of so many babies, literally, and the lives of a lot of the researchers and clinicians. And a lot of families. We should also mention his partner, Dr. Steptoe, who passed away several years ago and who was not a candidate for the Nobel Prize simply because it's only given to living people. Mm. But Steptoe and Edwards are iconic in our lives, and they opened our eyes to what we can do and not to be deterred when our research goes very slowly. And having the faith that with good endeavor, good science, we can achieve great things.
It's fascinating to go back and read what the lengths that they went to in the early days of their research into IVF. I mean, I was reading that, for example, Dr. Edwards would collect harvested eggs from women in one part of the UK, put them in a test tube, and strap them to his leg to keep them warm while he rode the train back to Cambridge in order to fertilize them in his lab.
Yes, yes. No, there are many stories of how we need to maneuver eggs and sperm so that we can fulfill the requirement of the law and so on. There's some people who have eggs retrieved in, I know in Europe they were retrieving eggs in some cities and then transporting them. But this time it's better than having a leg. It was having a portable incubator.
Robin Morantz-Hennigau, I'm going to get to you in just a moment, but Dr. Oskowitz, I wanted to ask you if you could sort of give us a sense as to the shape of IVF services in Massachusetts today. I understand that we're one of the leading states in terms of the numbers of procedures that are done in Massachusetts.
Well, the beauty of Massachusetts, of which there are many, is the fact that we have a very logical insurance mandate that ensures that about 85% of our patients who are infertile can have coverage. And it's a liberal, comprehensive coverage which includes all treatments from the most minor all the way through multiple IVF attempts.
I mean, more specifically, it's private insurers are required to cover, what, six IVF attempts?
Well, the law doesn't prescribe the number, but the insurance companies have managed to have some agreements with their patients that will be about six. In other words, they have several opportunities and there's much less pressure on the patients to return multiple embryos, and this way it's safer for our patients, and also more patients have access to this kind of treatment. We were, Massachusetts was a leader in this in 1987.
And so that amounts to now, what, roughly 8,000, I read, attempted implantations in Massachusetts a year?
That's correct.
Okay. And correct. And what, 3,000 alone done by your group, Boston IVF?
Yes. Yeah, so we have a group of individual private practices all working out of the same institution. We do teaching and the research through the Beth Israel Hospital, and we are therefore very happy to be able to do these procedures and see the babies that come from them.
It's a remarkable number. And Robin Morantz-Hennig, that leads me to ask you, I mean, I wonder what your take is. This is essentially in part what your book was about how quickly attitudes changed from those early days in 1978, where so much of this research basically had to be done under the cover of darkness, to, as we just heard now, Dr. Oskowitz saying that in Massachusetts, at least, you know, there are 8,000 IVF cycles performed every year. What does that change tell you about society's acceptance of reproductive science?
Well, if you go back to the 80s, that when Elizabeth was born at the end of 1981, because it was illegal in Massachusetts, they had to go to Virginia. And then it was only a couple of years later when the first Massachusetts clinic actually opened. That kind of change was happening over and over again in the early 80s because more and more healthy, normal babies were born. And it was really stunning that as long as the babies that were being born were healthy, people quickly forgot about all of the fears that they had, and we now totally forget. You know, you alluded to the Franken baby. I mean, they were sure, including pretty sympathetic doctors, were sure that this manipulation of eggs and sperm in the lab could only cause damage to the chromosomes. They couldn't imagine how there would be normal babies born. Once you saw that it worked, all of those fears, well, many of those fears at least, really fell away, which was dramatic to me. It's actually the way new technologies are introduced into society over and over again. There's all this concern about trying something new and where it's going to lead, and lots of talk about a slippery slope, that if IVF itself isn't so dangerous, think of all the other things that could happen as if we allow this to begin this way. And then pretty quickly, that whole discussion changes, and we are not quite as afraid anymore. It's much scarier in prospect, some of these new technologies, than what we actually live with.
Well, Elizabeth Comeau, that leads me back to you because, I mean, you lived this. This is the story of your life. I mean, after you were born, interest didn't wane. I mean, I read that, when you were 10 years old, there was a whole resurgence of reports around you to see if you had come, ended up quote-unquote normal.
Right, exactly. I'm still proving I'm normal or abnormal, depending on who you ask. Yeah, I mean, especially when I was 10, it had been a decade. So it was like, okay, well, she's grown up. She's becoming a preteen. Is she like everybody else? Does she have the same developmental capabilities, or, is she physically look any different, or, and that kind of, that continues still. I mean, when I had my son, People wondered, well, she was a test tube baby. Is she going to have a test tube baby, or is she going to have a normal pregnancy and, you know, everything else? So, yeah.
Well, we're talking about in vitro fertilization and the fact that the pioneer of IVF, Dr. Robert Edwards, passed away yesterday, and the state of the science here in Massachusetts and what the story about IVF's acceptance by society tells us about how quickly society may or may not accept future changes. Aggressive changes, perhaps, in reproductive technology. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm speaking with Elizabeth Comeau. She was America's first IVF baby, born on December 28, 1981. She now works as a senior health and wellness producer at Boston.com. I'm also talking to Robin Marantz Hennig. She is author of Pandora's Baby, How the First Test Tube Baby Sparked the Reproductive Revolution, and with Dr. Selwyn Oskowitz. He's co-founder of Boston IVF, the first and largest private IVF clinic in Massachusetts. Let's take a call here. Marcia is calling from Danville, New Hampshire. You're on the air, Marcia.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. What's your thought today?
Well, I just wanted to say hi to Dr. Oskowitz. My name is Marcia Belladin. He may not remember me, but 21 and a half years ago, well, actually it would be 22 years ago, we had a gift procedure with him, and I have 21-year-old twins.
Oh, that's fabulous. Very heartwarming.
Marcia, what was the experience like for you?
You know, I was in the system for 13 years prior to that success, so I had a lot of experience. And one of them, Dr. Oskowitz might remember, probably won't, but nevertheless, things had changed radically from the very beginning to the time that we had our success. I had gone through a lot of failures, but one of them was in the very beginning I had to have a hysterectomy, which is something he can explain better than I can, but it was a very painful procedure in the very beginning. And then later, 13 years later, I had the procedure again, and he had to talk me into it. Mm. And it was a breeze. Things had changed so much. And by the time I had got to the last procedure, it was, by my own decision, the last thing I could possibly go through. Mm. And it worked. And we're ecstatic.
Marcia, thank you so much for sharing your story, and thank you so much for your call. Let's move to take another one here. Camille is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. You're on the air, Camille.
Of all places. Yeah, two things. One is I kind of have objections to in vitro fertilization simply from a population standpoint. It seems there are enough humans on the planet to be sufficiently populated at this point. And so I don't really get that, the ego having to reproduce itself. Additionally, I was wondering, in Massachusetts, do you have any laws in terms of sexual abuse history with either the sperm donor or the egg donor, as in would a couple where perhaps the male had a sex abuse charge against a minor perhaps be able to get in vitro?
Mm. Okay. Camille, thank you so much for your call. Let's take your first point, and let me turn that to Robin Marantz Hennig, actually, and start with you. I mean, I'm fairly certain that Camille is actually not the only one who feels that way, that perhaps, you know, for couples who can't conceive naturally, that may be nature speaking to them, saying you're not meant to have children, so why go to the lengths of having IVF? That's not a criticism that's gone away.
Right, and there is a lot of concern about that, about overpopulation, about sometimes some of the techniques that you use for reproductive technology actually make people who have really weak sperm, for example, allow the sperm entry into the egg that it wouldn't possibly have had any other way, and so people are a little concerned about introducing damaged sperm that way. It's not easy to adopt children, so there's that. It's still kind of a difficult road to go. Mm. And I think that there really is a certain kind of understandable biological impulse to want to have your own children. It's easy to discount some of these couples as being, you know, egotistical and wanting to have it all just because they have the money to, but there's also this really deep urge to want to have a child. So I understand the criticism, but I also understand the impulse.
Yeah. Elizabeth Comeau, I wonder, I mean, did you ever have this conversation or other people ask your parents, why did you go to these lengths?
Yeah, it's been a question that's been asked of my family continually over the years. And really what it comes down to is exactly what Robin said, is that my parents just wanted to have a child of their own. And, you know, in my experience, the people that have pursued IVF are the people that should be having children. They really want to love a child. And many of them, as Robin said, will pursue. My parents were pursuing adoption. But, I mean, that is a long and arduous process. And so, you know, a lot of these people just really, you know, really just want to have a child to love. And that's bottom line what it comes down to.
In the last couple minutes that we have left, Dr. Oskowitz, I've got a quick set of questions for you, and that is in terms of the state of the science of IVF. Because, for example, I recall that last year in The Lancet, the British medical journal, there was a study reported, published, that suggested that the implantation of multiple embryos, more than two, really should be stopped because the technology is so good that there's no need to risk having, quote-unquote, octomoms anymore.
Well, you know, with all the excitement about this treatment, we forget that it's still a very difficult process, and that there are lots of couples who never succeed, and that science only can do so much. And sometimes we do need to work with extra embryos. There are couples, for example, whose embryo quality is poor, and our selection, even though it's getting better every day, selection of embryos is still not adequate enough, and we may have to place extra embryos. So I don't see the use of multiple embryos disappearing altogether, but yes, in patients that are very young and who produce high-quality embryos, we should be using only one, and therefore not running into the problem of twins.
Mm. And in your mind, since you did co-found Boston IVF, the oldest such clinic in Massachusetts, what do you think that the story of IVF tells us about the next great wave of advances in reproductive technology? Where might we go from here?
Well, we're going in a very nice direction. You know, I was on the team of Dr. Melvin Tamor at Beth Israel, where we delivered the first IVF baby in Massachusetts in 1984, just 3 years after Ms. Kamau was born. Mm. And since then, we've been able to treat some very infertile males who can now be parents by the process of what you call ICSI, where sperm is injected. And there are a lot of people who thought it would create monsters, but that doesn't happen.
Dr. Oskowitz, I'm sorry that I have to cut you off there, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Selwyn Oskowitz, co-founder of Boston IVF, and Robin Morantz Hennig, author of Pandora's Baby, thank you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And Elizabeth Kamau, senior health and wellness producer at Boston.com and America's first IVF baby. Thanks so much as well.
Thank you.
Listeners, stick with us or leave us. First of all, leave us your comments at RadioBoston.org and stick with us, because when we come back, we'll hear the story of former Monkees rocker Mike/Michael Nesmith. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.